This is an ABC podcast.
For a long time, the question has been how to stop catastrophic climate change. But lately, we've started asking something different, and that's which parts of the Earth will even be livable in the future, and which bits should we just write off altogether? In fact, there's even a name for those places. They're called sacrifice zones.
It's estimated that just by 2050, at about a little north of 2 degrees of warming, many of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East will become uninhabitable just by direct heat. You know, it'll be so hot that during the summer there, you won't be able to go outside.
I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell. And on today's episode of The Signal, as sea levels rise and temperatures go up as well, where in the world are the sacrifice zones? And what happens to the people who live there? So we cover climate change a lot, and shockingly, it never gets any better.
No, but even next to all those episodes we've dedicated to this topic, the idea of sacrifice zones is a specifically quite alarming one because it represents a huge shift, right, from talking about if we as a species are screwed to which parts of our only habitat, the Earth, are still salvageable.
Happy Friday!
The happiest of Fridays. So we called someone who knows all about this exact thing.
I'm David Wallace Wells. I'm the deputy editor of New York Magazine and the author of The Uninhabitable Earth.
Which is a terrifying name for a work of non-fiction.
Agreed, it is. So the first thing we wanted to know is exactly what we mean when we talk about sacrifice zones.
The basic idea is that given enough warming, there are going to be parts of the Earth that are basically uninhabitable, or at least so dramatically inhospitable, that it won't really make sense to invest in a continuing way in keeping human civilization alive in those places. And that may sound extreme, and it is extreme, but at the moment, there are already lots of places on the planet that are quite like that. You know, most of the deserts of the world are practically speaking, uninhabitable. Certainly the Antarctic and the Arctic are not parts of the world that are sort of naturally, support a lot of flourishing human life. So it's not as though this is, we're going from one system that is where everything is abundant and wonderful and prosperous to the prospect of another system in which huge parts of the globe are totally degraded. It's just a matter of degree, but how much of the planet could become endangered in this way? Quite a lot of it is really under threat. It's estimated that just by 2050, at about a little north of 2 degrees of warming, many of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East will become uninhabitable just by direct heat. You know, it'll be so hot that during the summer there, you won't be able to go outside, certainly wouldn't be able to work outside without risking heat stroke and death. And see, these are cities that today hold 10, 12, 15 million people. And the best science suggests that as soon as a couple of decades from now, 2050, those cities would be lethal to live in. And that's not to say that every single resident in each of those cities would drop dead immediately under those conditions. But, you know, over time, more and more of those health impacts will be felt. The impacts will be felt elsewhere where, you know, agriculture becomes less productive, and as a result, there's less food around, which impinges on the sort of social stability of the state. For all of these reasons, you know, some of these environments will just become less livable.
Okay, so straight up heat. That's one of the things that's going to be making these places uninhabitable, if the forecasts are accurate. And then there are the flow-on effects from that overall warming.
There are also the effects of drought and famine, which are going to be become much more widespread. The extreme weather, flooding could put whole parts of the planet underwater on a long timescale. The total melting of the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets, which I think is inevitable over many centuries, given where we're headed, will ultimately bring 260 feet or about 50, 60 meters of sea level rise. And that is enough to put underwater literally two-thirds of the world's major cities. Now, that'll happen over many centuries because it takes a long time for that ice to melt. But the geography of the planet will be transformed in quite dramatic ways by simply that matter of sea level rise.
So those are the main measurable ways that parts of the Earth are likely to become completely uninhabitable. And when that happens, there are these social effects that come into the frame.
When temperatures go up, crime rates go up, and murder rates go up, and rape rates go up. And when temperatures are higher, there are more incidents of mental illness. And no matter where you look on the whole spectrum of human behavior, At certain temperatures, things just become much more complicated. Economic growth becomes much more complicated because there's a relationship between economic productivity and temperature. It sounds a little deterministic, but economists have actually isolated an ideal temperature for economic productivity, which is about 13 degrees Celsius.
Really?
It's the historical temperature of the United States. It has to do with cognitive performance, which is affected by temperature. It also has to do with agriculture, which is deeply affected by temperature and is a big part of all of the world's economies. And then there's some things that we don't entirely understand about the dynamic. But when you do comparative analysis, it has this kind of remarkable finding that 13 degrees Celsius is the optimal level.
I think, you know, there's a conventional wisdom that the parts of the world, the places in the world that most acutely feel the effects of climate change at the moment are poorer parts of the world.
Poorer parts and Australia.
Right, us as well.
Big picture, climate change is going to affect everybody's life. It's in almost all cases going to make their lives worse. But the impacts are so concentrated in the equatorial part of the world and the tropics, where most of the world's poorest countries are, that big picture, I think that if you're really talking about parts of the world becoming uninhabitable, becoming sacrifice zones, almost all of those will be in that band, that central band, the equator and the tropics. But Australia is an outlier. So Australia is really like the world's one first world country that is already today dealing with climate change that only the rest of the developing world is dealing with. And I think in that way, they're kind of an interesting test case for how the wealthier parts of the world will respond when those impacts really arrive.
So the tropics and us.
Yeah, we're special.
So how will all that look when it starts to become more and more obvious which places are going to turn into sacrifice zones?
Well, David's already looked at this exact question in the US, where there are already some hints about which kinds of places governments are likely to prioritize.
Well, I think it's hard not to be cynical when thinking about that and assume that they'll save the most valuable real estate and protect the richest people and let the least powerful, least well-off people suffer. In New York, we just had an incredible heat wave the last couple of days, and the energy utility Con Edison had to shut off power to, I think the number was about 30,000 or 40,000 New Yorkers, in order to save the whole system, because they feared that if they didn't shut off these communities from their power sources, that the whole city would go dark. But of course, they weren't shutting off Tribeca. They weren't shutting off, you know, Greenwich Village. They weren't shutting off the places, the city where the richest people were living. They were shutting off parts of far-flung Queens and Brooklyn, where the constituents not only didn't have much money, they didn't have much access to political power to complain about it either.
So it follows that if there are these parts of the Earth that are currently very much lived in, that are gradually going to become uninhabitable, a lot of people are going to have to relocate. And, I mean, I guess the question is, how many?
Yeah, and no one really knows the answer to that question, but it will stretch into the millions. And depending how much the Earth warms and how far into the future we look, we're talking hundreds of millions, which is a lot of people to find new homes for.
Yeah, and that's a super uncomfortable thing for governments to try and broach when we're already not doing enough to avoid climate change. But privately, countries like Australia are starting to think about it.
The military is warning of a possible influx of climate refugees and the increased likelihood of conflict because of climate change. The Australian Defence Force...
So earlier this month, the ABC obtained briefing notes from the Australian Defence Force saying that they might have to send more patrol boats to Australia's northern waters to deal with an exodus of climate refugees heading in from the Indo-Pacific region. And the former Defence Force Chief Chris Barry went on the record saying we could be looking at 100 million people heading for our shores.
Yeah, if 100 million people from South Asia are looking for a new home and then decide to come here, the scale of the potential problem is huge. And I think that's a really good reason for Australia to do something now to try and head this off.
And that 100 million figure is very hypothetical. But that problem, whatever its size, is still very real. It's already something that the UN's Migration Agency, the International Organization for Migration, is looking at.
Everyone is concerned. I think that Australia has also a lot of risks of disaster and also drought and extreme heat. And it will imply also a lot of thinking and solutions for our own Australia's population, I think, to deal and cope with those elements.
That's Dina Ionesco. She's in charge of the IOM's climate change division. And the first thing you need to know is that right now there's no legal definition for a climate change refugee. In fact, the IOM doesn't even use that term. But that doesn't mean that people aren't being pushed out of their homes already by climate change.
So you can talk of slow onset, for instance, desertification or sea level rise, pushing people to move. And then we speak of very specific, what we call sudden onset events, which is really disaster type of displacement, floods, storms, typhoons, landslides.
Okay, so the majority of these displacements at the moment are through Asia, places like the Philippines and China, plus some in Africa and the US. But a lot of the movement is still internal, so these people aren't fleeing their countries, they're just heading to the next city or state that isn't as badly affected by the disaster.
Right, so you're probably starting to get a sense of how muddy this problem is. The numbers are all over the shop, and part of the reason for that is because it's almost impossible to untangle why people leave their homes, even when climate change is the main factor.
Very often, what we talk of climate change, whether sudden or slow, it's mixed to other factors. It's rarely just this specific driver, that it's the sole driver of migrants, which makes it also very difficult to isolate.
Yeah, that's the thing I wanted to ask you about, actually, because, I mean, there's always been, for example, floods or the, you know, degradation of, you know, ecosystems for a variety of reasons. How do you untangle what's happening as a result of climate change and what might have happened anyway?
Yes, it's very often difficult to attribute to necessarily to climate change. And it's very often difficult to isolate, for instance, the economic reasons from the climate change drivers. Very often, if you do, for instance, research and you ask why have you moved to a family, you will be said, I lost my job. But if you go one step further and you try to understand why the person lost the job, then you have always, for instance, there was drought or a event such as a flood that has been the main reason for it. So in fact, we try to give really visibility and to better understand the environmental drivers and to really try to understand the part that can be attributed to climate change while also keeping an eye on everything that is ecosystem degradation due, for instance, to human management. So it's a very complex story and a complex situation.
So it sounds like the numbers, exact numbers, would be pretty difficult to calculate. But to the extent that that is possible, do we know how many people have already been displaced from their homes by climate change?
So we know, for instance, that in an average since 2013, each year, 25 million people are, in average, newly displaced by this sudden onset event. And last year in 2018, more than 17 million people were displaced due to this disaster type of movements, compared to 10 million who were displaced by conflict. So it's huge. In the same time, we try to have good data now also on slow onset, but it's much more difficult to capture.
So this is one of the big problems with climate migration. Because the numbers are so inexact, it makes it easy for the people who should be finding solutions to deny there's a problem and keep ignoring it.
Right, and on top of that, the people that live in these places most of the time will do almost anything not to leave their homes, which means the victims, as well as the policymakers, are in a degree of denial. Combine that with the slow motion onset, and it's easy to see how nothing gets done.
I think the likelier future is not abandoning whole parts of the planet. It's just learning to live with much, much more suffering. And in a certain way, you can think of that as encouraging because it's a sign that our civilization will go on. On the other hand, it's incredibly tragic and discouraging that rather than taking action to avoid some of these outcomes, we're just going to let them happen and then treat them as though they were normal when we know from history that they're anything but.
We're so good at adapting.
Yeah, I think it's possible to be too good at that.
That is it for The Signal today and also for this week.
Yeah, and actually I am out of here for like 5 weeks. I'm going to Edinburgh to perform a comedy show at the Edinburgh Fringe because apparently I don't know how to have a holiday. So I will be seeing you in September. Please try not to burn down the pod.
No, I'm not making any promises. Although we will have Ruby Jones in the seat while you were gone, and she's very responsible, so she'll keep an eye on me.
Thank God, really? Bye for now.
See ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.